5. By 8 o'clock, the light was failing. The loudspeaker in the tower of the Stoke Pogues clubhouse began, in a more than human tenor, to announce the closing of the courses. Lenina and Henry abandoned their game and walked back towards the club. From the grounds of the Internal and External Secretion Trust came the lowing of those thousands of cattle which provided, with their hormones and their milk, the raw materials for the great factory at Farnham Royal. An incessant buzzing of helicopters filled the twilight. Every 2.5 minutes a bell and the screech of whistles announced the departure of one of the light monorail trains which carried the lower-case golfers back from their separate course to the metropolis. Lenina and Henry climbed into their machine and started off. At 800 feet, Henry slowed down the helicopter screws and they hung for a minute or two poised above the fading landscape. The forest of Burnham beaches stretched like a great pool of darkness towards the bright shore of the western sky. Crimson at the horizon, the last of the sunset faded through orange, upwards into yellow and a pale watery green. Northwards, beyond and above the trees, the Internal and External Secretions factory glared with a fierce electric brilliance from every window of its 20 stories. Beneath them lay the buildings of the golf club, the huge lower-cased barracks and, on the other side of a dividing wall, the smaller houses reserved for Alpha and Beta members. The approaches to the monorail station were black with the ant-like pollulation of lower-cased activity. From under the glass vault, a lighted train shot out into the open. Following its southeasterly course across the dark plain, their eyes were drawn to the majestic buildings of the Slough Crematorium. For the safety of night-flying planes, its 4 tall chimneys were floodlighted and tipped with crimson danger signals. It was a landmark. "Why do the smokestacks have those things like balconies around them?" inquired Lenina.
"Phosphorus recovery," explained Henry telegraphically. "On their way up the chimney, the gases go through 4 separate treatments. P205 used to go right out of circulation every time they cremated someone. Now they recover over 98% of it. More than 1.5 kilos per adult corpse, which makes the best part of 400 tons of phosphorus every year from England alone." Henry spoke with a happy pride, rejoicing wholeheartedly in the achievement, as though it had been his own. "Fine to think we can go on being socially useful even after we're dead, making plants grow."
Lenina, meanwhile, had turned her eyes away and was looking perpendicularly downwards at the monorail station.
"Fine," she agreed. "But queer that alphas and betas won't make any more plants grow than those nasty little gammas and deltas and epsilons down there."
"All men are physico-chemically equal," said Henry sententiously. "Besides, even epsilons perform indispensable services."
"Even an epsilon."
Lenina suddenly remembered an occasion when, as a little girl at school, she had woken up in the middle of the night and become aware, for the first time, of the whispering that had haunted all her sleeps.
"Alpha children wear grey. They work much harder than we do because they're so frightfully clever."
She saw again the beam of moonlight, the row of small white beds, heard once more the soft, soft voice that said, the words were there, unforgotten, unforgettable after so many night-long repetitions.
"Everyone works for everyone else. We can't do without anyone. Even epsilons are useful. We couldn't do without epsilons. Everyone works for everyone else. We can't do without anyone. Even epsilons."
Lenina remembered her first shock of fear and surprise, her speculations through half a wakeful hour, and then, under the influence of those endless repetitions, the gradual soothing of her mind, the soothing, the smoothing, the stealthy creeping of sleep.
"I suppose epsilons don't really mind being epsilons," she said aloud.
"Well, of course they don't. How can they? They don't know what it's like being anything else. We'd mind, of course, but then we've been differently conditioned. Besides, we start with a different heredity."
"I'm glad I'm not an epsilon," said Lenina with conviction.
"And if you were an epsilon," said Henry, "your conditioning would have made you no less thankful that you weren't a beta or an alpha."
He put his forward propeller into gear and headed the machine towards London. Behind them, in the west, the crimson and orange were almost faded,
a dark bank of cloud had crept into the zenith. As they flew over the crematorium, the plane shot upwards on the column of hot air rising from the chimneys, only to fall as suddenly when it passed into the descending chill beyond.
"What a marvelous switchback!"
Lenina laughed delightedly. But Henry's tone was almost, for a moment, melancholy.
"Do you know what that switchback was?" he said.
"It was some human being finally and definitely disappearing, going up in a squirt of hot gas. It would be curious to know who it was, a man or a woman, an Alpha or an Epsilon." He sighed. Then, in a resolutely cheerful voice, "Anyhow," he concluded, "there's one thing we can be certain of. Whoever he may have been, he was happy when he was alive. Everybody's happy now."
"Yes, everybody's happy now," echoed Lenina.
They had heard the words repeated 150 times every night for 12 years. Landing on the roof of Henry's 40-story apartment house in Westminster, they went straight down to the dining hall. There, in a loud and cheerful company, they ate an excellent meal. Soma was served with the coffee. Lenina took 2 half-gram tablets and Henry 3. At 9:20, they walked across the street to the newly opened Westminster Abbey Cabaret. It was a night almost without clouds, moonless and starry. But of this, on the whole, depressing fact, Lenina and Henry were fortunately unaware. The electric sky signs effectively shut off the outer darkness.
"Calvin Stopes and his 16 saxophonists." From the facade of the new abbey, the giant letters invitingly glared. "London's finest scent and colour organ, all the latest synthetic music."
They ended. The air seemed hot and somehow breathless with the scent of ambergris and sandalwood. On the domed ceiling of the hall, the colour organ had momentarily painted a tropical sunset. The 16 saxophonists were playing an old favourite, "There Ain't No Bottle in All the World Like That Dear Little Bottle of Mine." 400 couples were five-stepping round the polished floor. Lenina and Henry were soon the 401st. The saxophones wailed like melodious cats under the moon, moaned in the alto and tenor registers as though the little death were upon them. Rich with a wealth of harmonics, their tremulous chorus mounted towards a climax, louder and ever louder, until at last, with a wave of his hand, the conductor let loose the final shattering note of ether music and blew the 16 milli-human blowers clean out of existence. Thunder in A-flat major. And then, in all but silence, in all but darkness, there followed a gradual detergescence, a diminuendo sliding gradually through quarter tones down, down to a faintly whispered dominant chord that lingered on while the 5-4 rhythm still pulsed below, charging the darkened seconds with an intense expectancy. And at last, expectancy was fulfilled. There was a sudden explosive sunrise, and simultaneously the 16 burst into song.
"Bottle of mine, it's you I always wanted. Bottle of mine, why was I decanted? Bottle of mine, it's you I always wanted. Bottle of mine, why was I decanted? Skies are blue inside of you. The weather's always fine, for there ain't no bottle in all the world like that dear little bottle of mine."
Five-stepping with the other 400, round and round Westminster Abbey, Lenina and Henry were yet dancing in another world, the warm, the richly covered, the infinitely friendly world of Soma Holiday. How kind, how good-looking, how delightfully amusing everyone was. Bottle of mine, it's you I've always wanted. But Lenina and Henry had what they wanted. They were inside. Here and now, safely inside with the fine weather, the perennially blue sky. And when, exhausted, the 16 had laid by their saxophones, and the synthetic music apparatus was producing the very latest in slow Malthusian blues, they might have been twin embryos gently rocking together on the waves of a bottled ocean of blood surrogate.
"Good night, dear friends. Good night, dear friends."
The loud speakers veiled their commands in a genial and musical politeness.
Good night, dear friends.
Obediently, with all the others, Lenina and Henry left the building. The depressing stars had travelled quite some way across the heavens, but though the separating screen of the sky signs had now to a great extent dissolved, the two young people still retained their happy ignorance of the night. Swallowing, half an hour before closing time, that second dose of soma had raised a quite impenetrable wall between the actual universe and their minds. Bottled, they crossed the street. Bottled, they took the lift up to Henry's room on the 28th floor. And yet, bottled as she was, and in spite of that second gram of soma, Lenina did not forget to take all the contraceptive precautions prescribed by the regulations. Years of intensive hypnopedia and, from 12 to 17, Malthusian drill 3 times a week, had made the taking of these precautions almost as automatic and inevitable as blinking.
"Oh, and that reminds me," she said as she came back from the bathroom. "Fanny Crown wants to know where you found that lovely green Morocco surrogate cartridge belt you gave me."
Alternate Thursdays were Bernard's solidarity service days. After an early dinner at the Aphroditeum, to which Hernholtz had recently been elected under Rule 2, he took leave of his friend and, hailing a taxi on the roof, told the man to fly to the Fordson Community Singery. The machine rose a couple of hundred metres, then headed eastwards, and as it turned, there before Bernard's eyes, gigantically beautiful, was the Singery. Floodlighted, its 320 metres of white Carrara surrogate gleamed with a snowy incandescence over Ludgate Hill. At each of the four corners of its helicopter platform, an immense T shone crimson against the night, and from the mouths of 24 vast golden trumpets rumbled a solemn synthetic music.
"Damn, I'm late," Bernard said to himself as he first caught sight of Big Henry, the Singery clock.
And sure enough, as he was paying off his cab, Big Henry sounded the hour.
"Ford," sang out an immense brass voice from all the golden trumpets. "Ford! Ford! Ford!"
9 times. Bernard ran for the lift. The great auditorium for Ford's Day celebrations and other massed community sings was at the bottom of the building. Above it, 100 to each floor, were the 7,000 rooms used by solidarity groups for their fortnight services. Bernard dropped down to floor 33, hurried along the corridor, stood hesitating for a moment outside room 3210, then, having wound himself up, opened the door and walked in. Thank Ford, he was not the last. 3 chairs of the 12 arranged round the circular table were still unoccupied. He slipped into the nearest of them as inconspicuously as he could and prepared to frown at the yet later comers whenever they should arrive. Turning towards him,
"What were you playing this afternoon?"
the girl on his left inquired.
"Obstacle or electromagnetic?"
Bernard looked at her.
Ford, it was Morgana Rothschild.
And blushingly had to admit that he had been playing neither. Morgana stared at him with astonishment. There was an awkward silence. Then, pointedly, she turned away and addressed herself to the more sporting man on her left.
A good beginning for the Solidarity Service, thought Bernard miserably,
and foresaw for himself yet another failure to achieve atonement.
If only he had given himself time to look around instead of scuttling for the nearest chair. He could have sat between Fifi Bradlaugh and Joanna Diesel, instead of which he'd gone and blindly planted himself next to Morgana. Morgana! Ford! Those black eyebrows of hers...
That eyebrow, rather, for it met above the nose.
Ford!
And on his right was Clara de Turding. True, Clara's eyebrows didn't meet, but she was really too pneumatic. Whereas Fifi and Joanna were absolutely right. Plump, blonde, not too large, and it was that great lout, Tom Kawaguchi, who now took the seat between them. The last arrival was Sarangini Engels.
"You're late," said the president of the group severely. "Don't let it happen again."
Sarangini apologized and slid into her place between Jim Bokanowski and Herbert Bakunin. The group was now complete, the solidarity circle perfect and without flaw. Man, woman, man, in a ring of endless alternation round the table.
12 of them, ready to be made one, waiting to come together, to be fused, to lose their 12 separate identities in a larger being. The president stood up, made the sign of the T, and switching on the synthetic music, let loose the soft, indefatigable beating of drums and a choir of instruments near wind and superstring that plangently repeated and repeated the brief and unescapable haunting melody of the first Solidarity hymn. Again, again, and it was not the ear that heard the pulsing rhythm, it was the midriff. The wail and clang of those recurring harmonies haunted not the mind, but the yearning bowels of compassion. The president made another sign of the T and sat down. The service had begun. The dedicated Soma tablets were placed in the center of the table. The loving cup of strawberry ice cream Soma was passed from hand to hand and, with the formula, "I drink to my annihilation," 12 times quaffed. Then, to the accompaniment of the synthetic orchestra, the first Solidarity hymn was sung.
For we are 12, oh make us one, like drops within the social river. Oh, make us now together run as swiftly as thy shining flivver. Come, greater being, social friend, annihilating 12 in one. We long to die, for when we end, our larger life has but begun.
12 yearning stanzas. And then the loving cup was passed a second time. "I drink to the greater being," was now the formula. All drank. Tirelessly the music played, the drums beat. The crying and clashing of the harmonies were an obsession in the melted bowels. The second Solidarity hymn was sung. Again, 12 stanzas. By this time, the Soma had begun to work. Eyes shone, cheeks were flushed. The inner light of universal benevolence broke out on every face in happy, friendly smiles. Even Bernard felt himself a little melted. When Morgana Rothschild turned and beamed at him, he did his best to beam back. But the eyebrow, that black two-in-one, alas, it was still there. He couldn't ignore it, couldn't, however hard he tried. The melting hadn't gone far enough. Perhaps if he'd been sitting between Fifi and Joanna. For the third time, the loving cup went round. "I drink to the imminence of his coming," said Morgana Rothschild, whose turn it happened to be to initiate the circular rite. Her tone was loud, exultant. She drank and passed the cup to Bernard. "I drink to the imminence of his coming," he repeated, with a sincere attempt to feel that the coming was imminent, but the eyebrow continued to haunt him, and the coming, so far as he was concerned, was horribly remote. He drank and handed the cup to Clara de Turding. "It'll be a failure again," he said to himself. "I know it will." But he went on doing his best to beam. The loving cup had made its circuit. Lifting his hand, the president gave a signal. The chorus broke out into the third Solidarity hymn.
Feel how the greater being comes, rejoice and in rejoicings die. Melt in the music of the drums, for I am you and you are I.
As verse succeeded verse, the voices thrilled with an ever-intenser excitement. The sense of the coming's imminence was like an electric tension in the air. The president switched off the music, and with the final note of the final stanza, there was an absolute silence. The silence of stretched expectancy, quivering and creeping with a galvanic life. The president reached out his hand. And suddenly a voice, a deep, strong voice, more musical than any merely human voice, richer, warmer, more vibrant with love and yearning and compassion, a wonderful, mysterious, supernatural voice spoke from above their heads, very slowly.
"Oh, Ford! Ford! Ford!"
it said diminishingly and on a descending scale. A sensation of warmth radiated thrillingly out from their solar plexus to every extremity of the bodies of those who listened. Tears came into their eyes, their hearts, their bowels seemed to move within them as though with an independent life. Ford! They were melting. Ford! Dissolved, dissolved. Then, in another tone, suddenly, startlingly, "Listen!" trumpeted the voice. "Listen!" They listened. After a pause, sunk to a whisper, but a whisper somehow more penetrating than the loudest cry. "The feet of the greater being," it went on and repeated the words. "The feet of the greater being." The whisper almost expired. "The feet of the greater being are on the stairs." And once more there was silence, and the expectancy, momentarily relaxed, was stretched again, tauter, tauter, almost to the tearing point. The feet of the greater being, oh, they heard them. They heard them coming softly down the stairs, coming nearer and nearer down the invisible stairs, the feet of the greater being. And suddenly the tearing point was reached, her eyes staring, her lips parted. Morgana Rothschild sprang to her feet. "I hear him!" she cried. "I hear him!" "He's coming!" shouted Sarangini Engels. "Yes, he's coming! I hear him!" Fifi Bradlaugh and Tom Kawaguchi rose simultaneously to their feet. "Oh! Oh! Oh!" Joanna inarticulately testified. "He's coming!" yelled Jim Bokanovsky. The president leaned forward and, with a touch, released a delirium of cymbals and brone blast, a fever of tom-tomming. "Oh, he's coming!" screamed Clara de Turding. And it was as though she were having her throat cut. Feeling that it was time for him to do something, Bernard also jumped up and shouted, "I hear him! He's coming!" But it wasn't true. He heard nothing, and for him, nobody was coming. Nobody, in spite of the music, in spite of the mounting excitement. But he waved his arms, he shouted with the best of them, and when the others began to jig and stamp and shuffle, he also jigged and shuffled. Round they went, a circular procession of dancers, each with his hands on the hips of the dancer preceding, round and round, shouting in unison, stamping to the rhythm of the music with their feet, beating it out with the hands on the buttocks in front. 12 pairs of hands beating as one, 12 buttocks slabbily resounding. 12 as one, 12 as one. I hear him coming. The music quickened, faster beat the feet. Faster, faster fell the rhythmic hands, and all at once a great synthetic bass boomed out the words which announced the approaching atonement and final consummation of solidarity, the coming of the 12 in one, the incarnation of the greater being. "Orgy, porgy," it sang, while the tom-toms continued to beat their feverish tattoo. "Orgy, porgy, Ford and fun, kiss the girls and make them one. Boys at one with girls at peace. Orgy Porgy gives release!" "Orgy Porgy," the dancers caught up the liturgical refrain. "Orgy Porgy, Ford and fun, kiss the girls!" And as they sang, the lights began slowly to fade, and at the same time to grow warmer, richer, redder, until at last they were dancing in the crimson twilight of an embryo store. Orgy Porgy. In their blood-coloured and fetal darkness, the dancers continued for a while to circulate, to beat and beat out the indefatigable rhythm. Orgy Porgy. Then the circle wavered, broke, fell in partial disintegration on the ring of couches which surrounded, circle enclosing circle, the table and its planetary chairs. Orgy Porgy.
Tenderly, the voice crooned and cooed. In the red twilight, it was as though some enormous negro dove were hovering benevolently over the now prone or supine dancers. They were standing on the roof. Big Henry had just sung 11. The night was calm and warm.
"Wasn't it wonderful?" said Vivi Bradlow. "Wasn't it simply wonderful?"
She looked at Bernard with an expression of rapture, but of rapture in which there was no trace of agitation or excitement, for to be excited is still to be unsatisfied. Hers was the calm ecstasy of achieved consummation. The peace, not of mere vacant satiety and nothingness, but of balanced life, of energies at rest and in equilibrium, a rich and living peace. For the Solidarity Service had given as well as taken, drawn off only to replenish. She was full, she was made perfect, and she was still more than merely herself.
"Didn't you think it was wonderful?" she insisted,
looking into Bernard's face with those supernaturally shining eyes.
"Yes, I thought it was wonderful," he lied and looked away.
The sight of her transfigured face was at once an accusation and an ironical reminder of his own separateness. He was as miserably isolated now as he had been when the service began, more isolated by reason of his unreplenished emptiness, his dead satiety. Separate and unatoned, while the others were being fused into the greater being, alone even in Morgana's embrace, much more alone indeed, more hopelessly himself than he had ever been in his life before. He had emerged from that crimson twilight into the common electrical glare with a self-consciousness intensified to the pitch of agony. He was utterly miserable, and perhaps, her shining eyes accused him, perhaps it was his own fault.
"Quite wonderful," he repeated. The only thing he could think of was Morgana's eyebrow.